The Augustin Hosinga Show with your host Augustin Hosinga.
Smack the shit out your bitch ass midget girlfriend, nigga.
Hello there, welcome back to the Agostino Zynga Show with I, your host, Agostino Zynga, and this is episode number 751, that's 751, with I, your host, Agostino Zynga. Hope you're doing well wherever this podcast may find you. I hope you are doing swimmingly. How am I? All good, all things considered. I have just finished watching United beating Nottingham Forest 1-0 away from home in the FA Cup. A really horrible football match, I think, especially if you're a United fan. Maybe if you're a Forest fan, you feel a bit hard done by because they missed a few chances. They didn't have their shooting boots on. Most of their shots on goal were hit right at the keeper. Even though he pulled off some good saves, they were mostly at him, so he didn't really have to work that much for them. But if they had their shooting boots on, if they're a bit more clinical up front, they probably could have won. But on the Man United side of things, terrible game to watch. That first half legitimately sent me to sleep. Just about managed to wake up for the second half, and again an absolute doozer. And then we end up nicking it right at the end with Casemiro coming up clutch, flicking the ball into the goal from a very fast and low Bruno Fernandes free kick into the box. So again, good result, terrible performance. If anything, it papers over the cracks, doesn't really address any of our issues, doesn't really advance the conversation anywhere in terms of where the club should go next. I'm still of the thinking that you give Erik ten Hag until the end of the season, you see where the chips may fall. But at the moment, for me going forward, I'd much rather get a new coach in, especially in the summer. I just think he's been such a managerial catfish. It's been so annoying to see just how he hasn't tried even to implement that style of football he played at Ajax, at United. He's tried something completely different, this kind of gung-ho counter-attacking football thing that's going on, heavy metal football thing, but we don't even do that well. You know, it's one thing trying to play that system, but we don't even play it well. We don't have the players to play it well. He doesn't try to get the players to play it well. The transfer policy is all over the place. So I'm not even one of the people that wants to give him a chance with a better structure and all that stuff. I just think he hasn't earned any of that grace. He's been an annoying manager to kind of follow, to hear him talk waffle laps, to hear him talk absolute waffle in the press conferences. It kind of reminds me of the horrible era of like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, where he didn't really seem to have a clue what was going on. I'm just annoyed by him. I'm annoyed by the players. But there's a part of me that also feels like if you fire Erik ten Hag, you're almost rewarding the players, you know, in a weird way, because I'm not too sure if these owners have the power, have the control, have the authority to actually get rid of some of these players that we all want to get rid of. We all know the usual names. I just don't know if it's possible. That's the only thing. So if you sack Erik ten Hag, does it scapegoat the players? Do you scapegoat the manager and then protect the players? Or can you do both? Can you sack the manager and also get rid of all of those players who have not pulled up any trees, have flattered to deceive, have been completely disappointing, have incredibly massive, undeserving sized egos and need to be humbled? I'm not really too sure. But in the present, terrible as per usual. I don't think you're not watching United is for the faint-hearted. If you're a neutral, you probably shouldn't watch us play football because we're an incredibly boring team to watch. But I guess if you're a fan and you want to see us win a trophy, I guess it's good that we're going to the quarterfinals against Liverpool. I'm not really too bothered about it, to be honest, because I think once we face a decent team, we'll get knocked out anyway. But who knows? Who bloody knows? I also managed to watch Shane Gillis on SNL, and I really did enjoy it. I'm not going to lie. I saw Shane Gillis perform on SNL and I really did enjoy his opening monologue. I enjoyed most of the skits. I think I've got through about half of the skits. I haven't got through the entirety of it, but I thought his opening monologue was really good. I thought it was quite refreshing to see him nervous, I'm not gonna lie. It was good to see somebody do those monologues, and it looked like it was a big deal to him. And you can tell he's a real fan of comedy because he was legitimately taking in everything around him. He pointed to his mum and dad in the crowd and stuff. He had other family members there. That must have been a really sweet moment, especially when you consider everything that happened with him, right? In terms of his SNL career, in terms of him getting hired the first time around and then getting fired because that joke come about where he said something a bit dicey about Asian people and shit. To come back around and be hosting SNL, especially at the level that he's at. I think the Patreon, last time I checked, he's Matt and Shane's My Secret Time for his podcast. I think the Patreon was like making $500,000 per month or something. It might be one of the top, revenue making Patreons out there, which is flipping incredible. So he's come back onto SNL. His career is a much better place. He's just got a series greenlit with Netflix. He had a special on flipping Netflix. Everything's looking rosy. So it was pretty nice just to see him on stage doing his shit. I'm not gonna lie, I really did flipping enjoy it. But there are some people out there that didn't enjoy it. There are some people out there that basically say he bombed. I don't personally think he did. I personally think he had a typical stand-up comedian's performance. He started off a bit shaky, especially with being live TV, especially being a big deal, that kind of platform. But then he kind of, you know, saved himself and kind of got back onto the horse and was pretty okay after the first 2 minutes. He was pretty fine, I personally think so. So I think the bomb thing was a bit of an overreaction. And I'm not sure about you, but I actually like it when comedians, it's like, I always relate comedy to fucking DJing, but when you go and see a DJ play sometimes, or even when you listen to a DJ mix, it's nice when they clang. It's kind of nice when they fuck up because, you know, they're human. Oh, sometimes you fuck up. Sometimes it doesn't all go to plan. Sometimes you're playing vinyl and the needle skips and shit. Like, that's all part of the fun of the night. Or sometimes you're so drunk or high behind the decks, you press pause on the wrong one and you press it on the one that's meant to be playing, and the crowd sometimes makes some noise about that. That's all part of the fun. So people getting annoyed that he kind of looked nervous and he was kind of stuttering, or he sounded like he had a frog in his throat. Like, what do you expect, man? It's like primetime TV. I think SNL, if I'm not mistaken, is on Saturday, right? Hence the name Saturday Night Live. It's always filmed live in front of a live audience. He mentioned it in a stand-up special, in a stand-up he did on the monologue, that it's also under some super bright lights. What did you expect? Of course it's going to be nerve-wracking. So I wasn't perturbed by that, but some people were. And one of the people that were perturbed by it is this writer, courtesy of Vulture. The title is Anatomy of a Fail, right? So this writer from Vulture was not a fan of Shane Gillis at all. Let's see what he had to say about Shane Gillis's opening monologue, which I absolutely loved, by the way. I absolutely loved it. Let's see what he has to say. Shane Gillis made his return on Saturday Night Live last weekend. Now the role of the host 5 years after being fired for his very brief stint as co-member due to the series of racist, homophobic and sexist joke he had made on podcasts. It's been 5 years. That's pretty cool, you know, for him to achieve, because 5 years isn't a long time. For him to achieve everything he's achieved with the podcast, with Matt McCusker and shit, and everything he's done on his own, is pretty decent. In that 5 year time, he went to work. Instead of kind of moping around, feeling sorry for himself and grifting, he basically went to work, created a really popular podcast, made it really funny. Everybody kind of latched onto it, and then he kind of built it from there. Pretty amazing to see in 5 years what he's done. In the days since, the discourse on social media and in comment section has fallen into a pattern that's become predictable when quote-unquote offensive comedy is involved. Critics say that he struggled through a monologue that was tone-deaf and mean, while his fans argue that he crushed by forcing his uptight audience to hear some bad words. But it really isn't a matter of free speech, political correctness, or even cancel culture. Shane Gillis simply bombed. I don't think that's true, personally. Again, this is probably one of the hardest things to write about. Stand-up comedy, maybe similar again to DJing. Like, how can you say somebody have had a bad set? It's all just personal preference. It's all just like, what mood were you in? What type of things do you find funny? Like, do you already have an agenda about him anyway in the first place? Do you already have a narrative about him in the first? Like, all those things kind of play a role into how you review things. So it's hard to kind of give an unbiased review of a stand-up comedian, especially if you come at it from this kind of way. But let's continue. Gillis is not the first person to host SNL and attempt to do a potentially controversial material. Louis C.K. talked about child molestation in 2015. That might be still one of the best opening monologues of SNL history. That Louis C.K. one where he talks about flipping paedophilia. And basically makes a joke of like, oh, pedophilia is one of those things that's like abhorrent in society. We all know it's like a scarlet letter. You do it, you get caught, and it's like you're finished socially. But people keep doing it. So it must be really good. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of the joke he makes. And I remember listening to it for the first time and my jaw was on the floor, man. And like, obviously he made it way funnier than how I made it. But that Louis C.K. monologue of 2015 might be one of the greatest of all time. I swear to God. Chris Rock talked about how he'd never gone to the Freedom Tower in 2014. Dave Chappelle, after the 2016 election, talked about how he was going to give Donald Trump a chance. Bill Burr railed against white women in 2020 and 2023. Zach Galifianakis said a joke, "I like dark comedians. That's why I like Dwayne Brothers." Sorry, that's an incredible good line, isn't it, right? Big up Zach Galifianakis, right? How do you pronounce his fucking name, right? Big up Zach. "I like dark comedians. That's why I like the Wayne brothers." Do you know how good of a line that is? That is fucking genius writing comedy, that is, isn't it? Just over a year ago, Woody Harrelson used his monologue to offer up some COVID-19 conspiracies. Some of those host monologues generated backlash the next day, but they killed it on the night. For better or worse, those hosts got away with it. That's the art. That's what Gillis failed to do. Gillis's monologue made me think of the Anthony Jeselnik 2023 appearance on Fear of Warns this past weekend. All these comics now, it's like almost a point is to get in trouble. It's like, why are you giving me this shit? I'm a comic. I'm allowed to say whatever I want, Jeselnik explained. That's wrong, as far as I'm concerned. He then offers a quote from Andy Warhol. Art is getting away with it. You can talk about sensitive issues like sexuality or disabilities, but the audience needs to leave happy. That's art, Jeselnik added. Otherwise, you're just a troll. I find it funny how these kind of woke journalists are using Anthony Jeselnik as like one of their guys to kind of rally against. He wasn't talking about people like, He wasn't talking about people like Shane Gillis at all. Shane Gillis doesn't try to like be naughty for the sake of it. He just wants to be funny and say like funny shit. And if you know his style of comedy, you know what he did on that monologue is basically what he talks about on the podcast. It's what he does on stage. It's no different. He's not trying to like, you know, purposely poke and prod at people. So this is a very strange thing that they're basically using as a defense. But again, we continue. Some fans online were just excited that Gillis said the R word and gay on SNL. Others seemed to relish that the audience and the band behind him didn't enjoy it. Yeah, that was good as all, by the way. I'm not going to lie. I think there's a woman on his like left shoulder behind him that kind of looked like she was trying her best not to laugh. But everybody else kind of had like a deadpan face. They weren't enjoying it in the slightest. I've got to be honest. Maybe when he started to talk about his relatives with like Down syndrome and shit, then it started to kind of bit soften. Then when he dropped that his sister adopted black kids, you know what I mean? Like, he's got some stuff there that kind of gave him some bonus points. But the band members were looking a bit stone faced. They had that Andrea Pereira face. You know what I mean? Let's continue. They celebrate him being a troll on a bigger stage, but that's the misread of Gillis's comedy. He's not a troll comedian. He doesn't just throw inflammatory words into the act for the shock or get his rise out of the audience. Rather, he's getting away with it comedian. He has the ability to get audiences to laugh at ideas they don't agree with or words they don't agree with for being used in a self-deprecating and a personal perspective. And that ability to walk the line is what has earned him fans from all over the comedy spectrum. Pulling off the sensitive dance demands that the audience trust the comedian, and part of the trust comes from a sense of assuredness that the comedian knows what they're doing. Part of the reason Gillis's material doesn't go over well at SNL is that it does, Part of the reason why Gillis's material doesn't go over well on SNL as it does in his stand-up specials is that during his SNL monologue, he visibly was nervous on stage. He awkwardly has to wait a couple of seconds too long for someone to bring him the mic, then stammers through his first joke, which is a vague acknowledgement of the controversy of his 2019 SNL firing and hiring. The joke doesn't work, probably because fewer people in the audience actually know the details of what happened, of the joke would suggest, and Gillis does by telling people not to Google something is create a distraction, intrigue, and off-kilter energy. To be fair, this person does have a point. I'm not going to lie. I think that the microphone thing is dumb. I don't think it was that long. I think they're exaggerating about the hand mic. The passing of the microphone is weird. I actually found out odd anyway that they don't let you bring out the microphone in your hand. You come out on SNL on the stage, you get your applause, you do your little waves, and you're like, thank you for being here. And then somebody slowly, quietly hands you the mic at the front row. Why didn't you just give it to you in your hand and then just turn it on when you're about to speak? It's not that difficult, you know what I mean? But I don't know why they do it that way. But anyway, I think he didn't need to mention the controversy at all. He could have just probably alluded to it, like, it's nice to be back, you know? And then people would have laughed you know what I mean? And just kind of rolled on with that. Or just not acknowledged it at all. But I think the way he kind of tried to, like, you know, suggest that, oh, everybody must know about this contract, it's like, not really, you know what I mean? Even though it was a big deal to you, it probably wasn't a big deal to most people, and probably most people don't even know who he is. So it probably wasn't necessary to kind of go down that route. But again, I don't think it was that bad. The energy extends into his next bit when he delivers a punchline around 110 mark during his high school football coach joke when, even though you hear laughter in a clip, Gillis awkwardly pauses, laughs, and says all right to himself. The set continues and he gets the occasional punchline, but he fails to build a rolling laughter found in any of the good stand-up. Then there's the moment where he points to his father in the audience and mocks how his volunteer assistant girls high school basketball coach. I'm sorry, but that was fucking funny. When he kept pointing to his dad and saying that his dad was a volunteer assistant girls high school basketball coach, that was fucking hilarious. Like, come on. That was really funny. Basically calling your dad a pedo without calling him a pedo. That was fucking brilliant. Like, let's see that. Especially the ridiculousness of the role. Volunteer assistant girls high school basketball coach. Like, that's a hilarious title. It sounds like people in the studio are laughing, but Gillis reacts to the camera like it fully bombs, saying, I thought that was funny. Later in the set, he says, I can see everyone not enjoying it. You see, that's the thing about stand-up. If you just keep writing, repeating the jokes and just writing them down, it doesn't sound funny. Like, come on, man. This writer's fucking on a mad one. I thought it was funny. Later in the set, he says, I can see everybody not enjoying it. Just the most nervous I've ever been. It's surprising no one told him beforehand to act like he was killing it no matter what. Part of the probably... How are you going to tell a comedian what to do and how to be funny on stage? He should just pretend it like he was killing it. What, like fucking Bert Kreischer? Just keep laughing at your own jokes. Mic slapping your... You know, do a little mic knee slap. What are you talking about, bro? Sometimes if it's not going well, it's not going well. You can't just like maniacally like... convince yourself that it's going okay. Like, that's psycho behavior. Part of it is probably a lack of confidence. Most episodes of SNL start with a person literally doing stand-up for the first time, and it works because the stars know how to be poised on TV. This is the risk of asking someone to host who has no TV experience. Gillis was even more uncomfortable during the live sketches where he struggled to read cue cards. Now, I think he smashed the live sketches personally. I think this person's bugging out. Gillis' early monologue were from the safe, easy stuff that was supposed to get the audience on board for his dicier material later. Dicey. But how he plays it off, it seems, forces him to his position of trying to win the audience back. When he arrives at the Down syndrome section, it doesn't get the reaction he expects. He defensively jokes, look, I don't have any material that could be on TV. It's similar to Joey Coy blaming the Golden Globe writers during his monologue. But in this case, Gillis is blaming himself. It's not that the jokes weren't necessarily bad. Gillis just didn't succeed in attempting to tell them to his audience. Unlike the Globes, the SNL audience is excited to see comedy. So all the host needs to do is convey why they should be there and that it's going to be a fun show. And Gillis both explicitly and inexplicitly told the audience he shouldn't have been there, and it wasn't. Come on, man. This is pure hate. I think this is overboard. I think Gillis smashed it on the sketches. My favorite one of his was definitely the HR one. I thought the HR sketch was incredible. So funny. I laughed throughout the entire thing. I think he's a really good comedic actor, in my personal opinion. I think you've seen it from his sketches. You see it from the other show that he did. I forgot the name of it. But he's done quite a few bits and pieces online. And you can tell this guy has good comedic acting chops. So I think he was perfect for SNL. And if anything, this SNL appearance made me realize why they even booked him. Because I think in 2015... when you got announced for SNL, I couldn't work out why, because I wasn't that familiar with him, you know? So I was like, huh, interesting choice. But now that he's done SNL, I now get what they saw in him. Like, he's actually talented. Like, let's be real. Like, for the guys within the JREverse, like, if you want to tap in JREverse people, if you want to tap them up and if you want to use them for a project, a big project, there's not many within that JREverse, or extended universe who are any good outside of their comfort zone. Most of them can only perform in front of their home crowd. They can't really do anything else. They can't write. They can't do sketch comedy. They can't act. So you're kind of limited in what you can offer them, right? All you can offer them is what Bert did. You can just offer them a movie where you just, like, you know, you play yourself, basically. But they don't really have much range. And I think what Shane Gillis showcased is that he has a lot of range. He has a lot of comedic range. He's obviously very creative, very funny. He can apply that in different environments and shit. I thought that was awesome. The one thing that I would love to hear from him, hopefully he does talk about, I don't think he will, because I think he's going to be a lot more, I think he's, from now on, Shane's going to be a lot more, I wouldn't say PC, but he's going to be a lot more careful about what he says when it comes to the industry people. But I would love to know what happened when he walked into the SNL studios and he saw Bo and Yang for the first time. What did Bo and Yang say? Did Bo and Yang, like, come over and, you know, talk to him? Did they kind of, like, you know, settle their issues? Like, I wonder what happened. Like, did he kind of ignore him? Did he just pretend like did nothing happened? Like, because Bo and Yang was super critical of Shane Gillis when he got fired from SNL. I think he was one of the people that was actually campaigning for him to get fired. So I would love to see or hear how Bo and Yang was, because now, you know, Shane Gillis's career is, like, on fire. He's probably making way more money than Bo and Yang is. He's probably way more famous than him, especially in comedic circles. So I wonder what that kind of dynamic, what that kind of vibe was like in the room. But I enjoyed it. I had a good time with it. Big up Shane Gillis. Absolutely smashed it. And obviously now off the back of that, he's also got his pilot for that show called Tires that he was doing, where he filmed the pilot episode for. He's got that green lit for, I think, 5 episodes or something on Netflix, which I'm sure was all part of this whole thing. I'm sure that was part of the whole rollout of getting SNL, was like, hey, you smashed it. Here's a fucking SNL deal. And that's off the back of that. And he's going to be going to the fucking moon very, very soon. So big up Shane Gillis. Big up Shane Blood Clark Gillis. Moving on from that one, we've got this interesting post here, courtesy of the Berghain subreddit I want to quickly mention. The Berghain subreddit community, or the Berghain community subreddit, is one of my favorite subreddits out there. Up there with the Fire and the Kid, up there with Red Scare, which others do I use? Up there with the soccer fucking subreddit, up there with the techno subreddit, up there with Public Freakout subreddit. I fucking love the Berghain community subreddit. And I thought this post was super funny, because a lot of people in the comments didn't agree. So the title is, sharing a cabin means you have to share also your stuff, yes or no? And basically when they mean cabin, they mean basically a toilet, right? So if you go into the Berghain or most clubs within Berlin, they usually have decent enough toilets where you can go and do some of your drug ass and stuff, right? And usually they turn into kind of hangouts, because they just turn into hangouts. I'm not too sure why. I don't know. The toilets in Berlin aren't nicer than anywhere else in the world. They're still skanky. They're still covered in fucking urine and, you know, ejaculate and any other else, bodily fluids. So it's not like a nice place to go. But I think because of the whole culture around doing the drugs inside of a cubicle and not doing them on a dance floor, they turn into their own little spaces. So the cubicles turn into like another version of a smoking area where people go and just hang out and chill. And sometimes, like myself included, I've had some really, really great conversations in toilets, like to the point where you're like, oh my god, I've met my best friend. But obviously you're like tripping on fucking, you know, ecstasy and shit, so it's clearly your fucking emotions are super heightened. But I've had always a great time in there. And for me personally, I've been fortunate enough to be good vibes, because when you go into those type of places, you're obviously going into like a mostly LGBTQ queer space anyway. So you have to be a little bit understanding of the environment you're in. You kind of have to move accordingly. And sometimes, unfortunately, just because of the nature of the game, you know, I think on their side, they can just probably tell just by looking at you that you scream hetero, you stream straight, you stream flipping masculine energy. So sometimes it can kind of frighten them, and they sometimes just don't want to be near you. But sometimes if they do like the cut of your jib, they like your smile, they just think you're like you as a fucking black man. Sometimes in my case, I kind of have to use that. They will sometimes just say, hey, why don't you come in with us? And that's always one of the best validations you could ever get. If you go into like a fucking techno club in Berlin and the gay guys invite you into their cubicle to share drugs or to do drugs with them, that legitimately is one of the best stamps of approval you could ever have. That legitimately means that you have arrived, you've been accepted into community, you're part of it. Like, there's nothing more that brings a smile on my face than being invited into a fucking piss covered toilet with these strange ripped men, right? And doing drugs with them and talking about world affairs. It's fucking incredible. I absolutely love it. But for me, when I've always gone out, and again, maybe this is kind of sad. I'm going to preface it. This is kind of sad. But sometimes when I go out, I will sometimes go out of my way to bring more stuff than I need. in the hopes that sometime that I might bump into somebody and we might become friends and I can share some stuff. It's kind of fucking sad. It really is. Because I remember I was thinking about it the other day. Like, I used to do that with menthol cigarettes. Like, I've never been a smoker. I barely, if ever, smoke weed. But I can't really smoke cigarettes. Just not something that kind of vibed with me. I'm lucky about that. But sometimes when I was in my real losery era, when I was going to like Fold every other fucking weekend, this was like before the pandemic, right? I was at Fold literally every other weekend. I used to live there. I would sometimes buy menthol cigarettes in the hope that I would go to the smoking area and just be hanging out with people and be able to like make friends and befriend people in the smoking area by, you know, fake smoking these fucking menthol cigarettes. Which is sad, because if you know anything about a smoking area in a bar or a club, you don't need to smoke to stand in a smoking area. You can just go there to get some fresh air and just talk to people without having to fake smoke. Do you know what I mean? So I did all that shit and it was fucking ridiculous. But an extension of that is sometimes I will purposely bring more drugs than I need just so I might be able to share them with people. And I'm okay with that. And it doesn't matter what I have, I'll just reshare it because it's a nice thing to do. And sometimes I think in my head, it's nice sort of like karmically to be that person that kind of extends that olive branch. Like, hey, I know you don't have anything, so here's something here. Oh, they have to pay you. No, it's completely free. And then you can think maybe in the future, they might do the same thing for somebody else. They might kind of pass that favor on. Unlikely, because, you know, people are very possessive with their drug ass and shit. But I hope that could be the case. So let's flip and scroll down, right? Let's go down and see what some of these people say, because I'm curious to see what some of the flipping replies were from the people on this flipping community subreddit. So it says, sometimes you give, sometimes you take. Always happy to give to people. I'm vibing, and strangers have helped me in times of great need. It's fine to ask. Don't take that as a personal affront. Chill out. You can always politely say no, saying that you don't have to have much or something. Exactly. I don't really think that's a bad thing. Like, that's one of the things I think. If you're going to ask for one thing, don't ask for guest list. I think asking for a guest list to go into a club is kind of pathetic. I know there's some people that ask the guest list to go to a club when they don't have any money. I'm specifically the type of person that will not go outside if I don't have money. I'm very uncomfortable about going outside to a bar, to a restaurant, or just to see friends and not have a dollar to my name. Like, I have to have money. I have to have some money in my pocket. But some people are so fucking broke, are so damn bad, that they would actually go out and not have money in their pocket and then ask somebody to kind of give them stuff. It's like, that's ridiculous. But if you're going to ask somebody for something, I think asking for drugs is perfectly fine. Maybe a drink is perfectly fine. But asking for a guest list is redacted. That's losery. You should probably just stay your ass at home. My personal opinion. But I could be wrong. Another one says, lines for me are social things, so always share. Exactly. There's obviously a benefit in it. This person says, yes. Cocaine, no. I'm cheap. Let's continue here. Another person says, I always buy, exactly, see, this person's after my is on the same vibe that I'm on. I always buy more than what I need to be able to share. That's where I am as well. I always buy more than I need, always to share. Obviously somebody wants to give me money for it, then I'll flip and take it. Who wouldn't? But I'm not going around there trying to become fucking Pablo Escobar. It's just like, you know, if someone's, you know, you're catching a vibe with somebody, you're having a good time, the banter's there, you hand it to somebody. And also, it's not done as a ruse to start talking to girls. I see some guys do that too. Don't be that guy. Like, I know some guys out there that use it as a like tactic to start talking to girls. It's not that. If anything, it's like just it's like a little cherry on top of the little friendship exchange. Oh my God, I like that. Oh my God, you like that. Oh my God, I like your outfit. Oh my God. And then you have a little chat and then you hand somebody and it's like, that's it. And if anything, sometimes I hand it to somebody and I walk away. I'll be like, hey, here, have this. Oh, can I pay? No, it's paying fine. Take it. And then you walk away so that there's none of that kind of like, they don't feel like as if they like, now I have to like stand with you. Because that's sometimes the awkward thing about clubs. You give somebody something, then they feel as if they have to kind of like stand next to you, or they have to kind of be with you. They kind of like, it's almost like you own them. It's like, no, it's not that deep. I'm just giving it to you because you're a good vibe. We had good banter. We made each other laugh. Here, enjoy yourself. We'll see each other on a dance floor or whatever. I think that's perfectly fine. If you don't share, karma will remind you the next time at the bouncer. That's fucking ridiculous. That's dumb. You don't have to share your stuff if you don't want to. Bouncer's not going to do anything. That's fucking stupid. Another one says, sucks when you're solo in a full cabin though. Have to break off 6 lines just for sharing space. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Fair enough. Fair enough. But you don't have to give them 6 lines. You can easily, exactly as person says, you can easily give somebody a bump. You have to give them all six. That's fucking crazy. I think that's dumb. You could easily give them a bump. If they don't want a bump, then, you know, they don't get it. But you don't need to give them six full fucking lines, six slugs just to get into the cubicle. It's a crazy tax to pay. Another one says sharing is caring, whether it's drugs or hugs. Got lucky once by sharing blow and ended up getting a blowjob in return. Okay, I'm not advocating for this. I don't co-sign this sort of stuff. You don't need to exchange drugs for fucking sexual favors. That's not what I'm in it for. I'm just in it for the vibe. I'm in it for the banter. I'm in it for the community. I'm in it for the fucking random Instagram followers and stuff. And that's something also I have to be honest that I'm gonna stop doing. I think sometimes the magic of the encounter, of the conversation, of the chat, of the hang is lost when you straight away go, oh my god, let's be friends on Instagram, or let's follow. It just kills the conversation. I think sometimes when you're in a club and you're having a great time, I think it's nice just to have that great time and just center in it, just kind of be present in that great time you're having, smiling, bantering with each other. And then if you see each other later on, or you see each other at another party and then you want to exchange details, cool. But you don't need to do it in that moment. It's unnecessary. It kind of kills the conversation. It kind of like brings it to an abrupt halt. Oh my God. And now you're kind of awkwardly looking for your phone. You're trying to get network. You're trying to search for your name while your eyes are moving in different directions. It's not the way to go personally. I'm definitely going to stop doing that, because I've got an Instagram full of randoms who I don't know, you know, from nights out. And it's just like, you know, like, now what, you know? Why invite someone in if you just to make them stand there awkwardly? Or why join someone's cabbing and don't share? Don't be a cunt. Agree with that one. Not only in Berkeley and the underground scene in general. Used to be a yes after starting to test our own stuff beforehand. It's now usually a no. I guess. But that's kind of boring, isn't it? Just roll the dice. Drugs are for sharing. What kind of prick doesn't share their drugs? Exactly. And that's where I'll fucking love it. That's where I'll leave it there. Drugs are for sharing. What kind of prick doesn't share it? I don't know what kind of prick doesn't share it. Why bother going out if you're not going to share? I don't know. I don't know. Next on the list, we have some interesting news courtesy of Fold. So Fold have this new system going on now, or this new process, this new entry price for their legendary Sunday raves called Unfold. They're now going to be raising the entry price from £10 to £15. And they also have a membership process. So if you go to Unfold frequently enough, you can fill out a form that basically allows you to become a member so that you can sometimes skip the queue and whatnot, right? So we've got a caption here courtesy of Fold themselves. It says, a sunset in the steam room has long been an experience like no other, with rays lighting up the room in the midst of the surreal, steamy euphoria. Despite its smaller, more intimate nature, it's more than matches the level of energy generated by this bigger sibling and has become a favored space for many who attend. From now on, every edition of Unfold will feature the main room and a steam room. Unfold begins on Sunday, but over two rooms. As always, the lineup remains unannounced and tickets are only available in the door. With the increase of space comes the need for increased staff levels, and as such, we will be increasing the price of Unfold from £15 now onwards. For those with our Unfold membership cards, the price remains at £10. You can apply for these cards via the registration form in our bio. Queuing does not guarantee entrance, and this is a discretion of the entrance team. Please respect their decisions. Dress the sweat. So there's now going to be an entry process to enter into fucking Unfold, and I don't know if that's like membership. I don't know if that means the beginning or the end. If you start asking people to, you know, have membership cards to get into clubs on a Sunday, it's like, I don't know about that, but it's obviously a good way to kind of maintain your community, to make sure the people that are coming in are up on the up and up. It's another way to sort of like, you know, veto people and whatnot. So I guess it kind of works in that regard. This is the actual membership form. If you want to fill it out yourself, it's available on the link in bio on flipping, on Fold's Instagram a bio page. You can find their link tree, and then obviously you'll find the membership link if you scroll down. It's a basic membership form. It's got some easy questions here, like your name, your email address, home address, desired number you'd want, what's your favorite Unfold memory. You've got a picture here to upload of yourself and how you present yourself to Unfold so you can look cool. You've got another pictures off your ID and more confirmation down below, so you can apply there if need be. So that's going to be interesting to see if it does end up changing the name nature of people that are going there. But this person asked an interesting question regarding some of the membership here, right? And I'm going to post it on there. This person says, I have a question about the memberships, and sorry if this has been addressed elsewhere. Are there applications from anyone who attends regularly, or would you prefer that more privileged regulars opt to not apply as to keep the membership available for others who might not need them? I'm cis and waged. What? I'm cis and waged. What's waged? As in he's got a job. Is that how I identify? Is that an identity? To be cis and employed? What? Okay. I'm cis and waged. I'm cis and non-waged. Okay. And wouldn't want to apply if it's not appropriate, or what you're envisioning for the membership and the purpose of looking after the Unfold community. Thanks, and hope this is not too much of a ramble. The reply from Fold. The membership is designed for anyone who feels that they have a strong connection to Unfold and would like to play a part in shaping the future. It has several other purposes beyond the discount, some of which are detailed in the form. Others will be announced in the future, so we would encourage you to register. So they are encouraging everyone to register. There's going to be, is extra toilets here? What person said? Extra toilets? Nope, no extra toilets. So I guess, you know, £15 is decent enough for a day party. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Fold goes on from 12 to 12 on a Sunday. So even if you've been out on the weekend, even if you haven't been out on the weekend, it's a good way to kind of sweat and get yourself, you know, dancing again. And it's a great way to kind of start the week. So that's really good. And especially when you think that there's not many parties actually on a Sunday in London. So I don't really blame him for that. I just think sometimes I feel that myself because I'm naff, but I don't know, man, having a membership card to go to a nightclub is a bit, it feels a little bit lame. Yeah, I mean, it feels very, very lame, but I could be wrong. You know, maybe when I get my membership card and it's got some fucking shiny F logo on the back of it, I might completely change my tune. But so far, I'm a little bit like, let's see how it plays out. Let's see how that plays out. Moving on from that one, we have news courtesy of Bloomberg. Bloomberg, Bloomberg, Bloomberg. Bloomberg have announced that Apple is to wind down electric car effort after a decade-long odyssey. It says here, courtesy of Bloomberg, Apple is cancelling its decade-long effort to build an electric car, according to the people of knowledge of the matter, abandoning one of the most ambitious projects in the history of the company. Apple made a disclosure internally on Tuesday, surprising the nearly 2,000 employees working on the project, said the people who asked not to be identified. The decision was shared by Chief Operating Officer Jeff Williams and Kevin Lynch, and a vice president in charge of the effort, according to the people. So they spent quite a lot of time doing this. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's been 10 years in the making. Recently, they announced they were going to ramp it up a little bit. And I got to be honest, as I spoke to Rodeo Brito earlier, I really was looking forward to seeing design-wise what it would look like conceptually, what they were proposing. Would it be like a car that had no front and no back end? It was just like a round blob. Would it be an SUV? Would it be a hatchback? Would it be a saloon? Like, I was really curious to see what kind of car they would build. Would it be autonomous? You know, all these sort of things were kind of things I was kind of curious about, like the interior design, you know, all these type of things I would love to have seen Apple kind of, you know, lend their hand to, and of course how it would kind of integrate with the apps or the products they already have. But obviously we're not going to see that anymore. And it continues here. It says, the two executives told staffers that the project will begin winding down and that many employees on the car team, known as the Special Projects Team, will be shifted to the Artificial Intelligence Division under the direction of John. These employees will focus on generative AI projects and increasingly key priority of the company. So they're deciding to move mostly into AI. I guess that makes a lot of sense considering what's going on. But again, selfishly, I would have preferred to have seen the car. Apple Car Team also has several hundred hardware engineers and vehicle engineers, and it's possible they'll be able to apply for jobs on other Apple teams. There'll be layoffs, but it's unclear how many. So some people are actually going to get fired. Wow, man, that's harsh, isn't it? They ended the project. Instead of, you know, keeping most of the team and just, you know, spreading them across the company, now they're going to get let go. Apple, based in Cupertino, California, declined to comment. The move came as a relief to investors, who sent Apple shares climbing on Tuesday after Bloomberg reported the news. Elon Musk, the head of Tesla, also celebrated the move. He shared a post on X social media with a saluting emoji and a cigarette. The decision is ultimately a wind down the project is a bombshell for the company, ending a multi-billion dollar effort called Project Titan that would have vaulted Apple into the whole new industry. The tech giant started working on a car around 2014, setting its sights on a fully autonomous electric vehicle with a limousine-like interior and a voice-guided navigation. That would have been so cool. Can you imagine how cool that would have been? A limousine-like interior, voice-guided navigation, fully autonomous electric car. Can you imagine what that would have looked like? That would have looked so fucking cool. But to be fair to them, like Elon Musk has said many a times, it's really difficult to produce and manufacture cars to a high level. It's really difficult to do. I think he says, his famous quote is like, anybody can concept, it's hard to fucking produce or manufacture. I forgot what the concept, I know the quote, I fucked it, but it's somewhere along that kind of line. And one thing that I've kind of noticed about cars, especially in the last few years, I've been kind of, you know, checking out some channels here and there. The automobile industry is a bit fucked up. Like, I remember checking out a video of this guy who was trying to buy himself like a Porsche RS, a GTRS3 or something. One of the GTRS, right? One of those cars, the one that Brendan Schaub had, the one that flipping Joe Rogan has, right? It's a Porsche that all car enthusiasts seem to fucking love. And he went to just rock up to a Porsche dealership and buy one. And you know, you can't just buy a Porsche from a dealership. You have to get on the special list. So if you want a GT3R, a GT3 RS, right? So I think that's what I'm talking about, is it? I think it's a Porsche GT3 RS. Yeah, that's the one, right? If you want a brand new Porsche GT3 RS, you have to have bought different Porsches over the years that then allow you the privilege to buy this Porsche. Like, you can't just buy it. Like, if I have the money to buy it, which is $500,000, however much it is to buy this car, I can't just rock up and buy one brand new. I have to be first, have a history of buying Porsches and have a history of buying. And it's not just any Porsche. You have to buy certain Porsches of a certain value, and then you can have the ability to go buy a Porsche GT3 RS. So, that whole scam in the car industry thing is something that a lot of, you know, car companies do. So clearly that's something that they would have to break. And I think Tesla's one of the people that did it, where you can just walk into a dealership and kind of buy a Tesla straight off the fucking showroom, but you can't with other companies. So I would have been curious to have seen how Apple would approach the buying process of a car. Like, where would you have picked it up? Would you have picked it up at like a, you know, as specific Apple stores? Would you have gone to like an Apple car dealership somewhere? Could you get delivered to you the next day? Do you have to wait a week? Like, all those fucking crazy things around the production and manufacturing and delivery of cars, I would have liked to have seen Apple's kind of you know, little flip and little nod at it. But I guess we're never going to see it now. It continues, but the product struggled nearly from the start, with Apple changing the leadership and strategy several times. Lynch and Williams took charge of the undertaking a few years ago, following the departure of Doug Field, now senior executive at Ford Motor Company. Apple, still years away from producing a car, contemplated many different designs. Beyond the look of the vehicle, cracking self-driving technology was a major challenge. That's something that I've been surprised is difficult. I'm not going to lie. I've been actually surprised by how difficult it seems to crack full self-driving. Like, it just doesn't seem to be a thing that we're any close to really getting. Like, full self-driving, like, actually shipping and actually being something that gets implemented to the point where then we start having robo-taxis. No one's really willing to take that risk just yet. Apple had road-tested its service, system since 2017, using a Lexus SUV exterior, putting the dozens of vehicles on the road in the US. The company also tested more secretive components on a gigantic track in Phoenix that was once owned by Chrysler. So, unfortunately, it's gone. It's flipping over. No more flipping Tesla car happening anytime soon. Most likely, you would imagine the Apple Vision Pros played a role in it, AI's played a role in it, and they're going to put all their chips in there. So if you're looking forward for an Apple car, unfortunately the Apple car dream is over. Unfortunately, the Apple car dream is over. One thing that isn't over, talking about electric cars, is Elon Musk announcing, courtesy of his Twitter, that the new Tesla Roadster is coming next year. I'm sure the Tesla designers, the Tesla employees weren't happy with him just randomly dropping the bombshell, but he announced via his Twitter that it's coming. It's flipping coming. And I thought the revelations on his Twitter were really interesting. So he said the other day, tonight we radically increased the design goals of the new Tesla Roadster. There will be no other car like this, if you could even call it a car. There will be no other car like this, if you can even call it a car, right? Fucking very big words here. Tesla/SpaceX collabo. I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean it's going to fly? Does that mean, like, I don't know. What the fuck does that mean? Does that mean it's light enough to put into fucking, what's it called? to be a part of the, you know, when the fucking rocket goes to fucking Mars, I'm not looking too sure. Production design complete and unveil end of year, aiming to ship it next year. I think it has a shot at being the most mind-blowing product demo of all time. So I wonder, will it be able to kind of lift off from like a standing start? Will it be able to actually fly in the air or something? Will it be able to go underwater? Like, what the fuck is it going to be able to do? Will it be able to do it for like a 360 turn? Like, what the fuck is it going to be able to do? Somebody said here, testing, targeting a 0 to 60 mile time under 1 second. He said the 0 to 60 time is going to be 1 second, and that's the least interesting part. Can it fly a little? The eyes. So clearly it's going to be a flying thing, and it's going to be a collaboration between Tesla and SpaceX. Can you imagine? It can includes here. Let's see what it says here. It says, Wow. Okay, so this is an update. SpaceX option package for the new Tesla Roadster will include 10 small rocket thrusters arranged seamlessly around the car. These rocket engines dramatically improve acceleration, top speed, braking, and cornering. Maybe they'll even allow a Tesla to fly. 19 years ago, when my first company got bought, I had to decide between buying a house in Palo Alto or a McLaren F1. Best car ever, in my opinion. Was no contest. I bought the F1 and a small condo that was much cheaper than the car. New Tesla Roadster will exceed all gas sports car in every way. So he's been talking really big and boasty about the Tesla Roadster for a while, 2018. And now he said here at the end, you will love the new Roadster more than your house. I am so curious to see what this final design of the Roadster looks like. I really can't wait to see what that looks like. I'm curious to see how it's going to be a collaboration between SpaceX and fucking Tesla. It's going to be fucking incredible. I cannot wait. So big up Elon. Can't wait to see what that actually ends up looking like. We have no, you know, idea if they're any closer to actually completing it, because we've always been given loads of false dawns. So maybe this might be another one of them, but we have to flip and wait to see. We'll have to wait and see. Moving on from that one, we have this. This PDD story that obviously features Meek Mill has been doing the rounds on my end of social media, and I'm sure most of your guys' ends of social media also. And am I the only person that can't really figure out why this is a big deal? I always assumed Diddy was a party boy, and being a party boy is doing some party boy shit. And what I've heard about Diddy so far is that he's into some party boy shit. That's what party boys do. If you have the means that he has, if you have the money that he has, if you have the fucking access that he has, the connections that he has, right? The charisma that he has, the history that he has, of course you're going to do the stuff that he does. Because why else wouldn't you? That's what real rock star people do. The only weird thing about it is that he's still doing it now at his, you know, advanced age. He hasn't really slowed down, right? He hasn't really kind of taken his foot off the pedal. He hasn't decided to settle down, have a family or get married. He hasn't decided to kind of hang up his social kind of cape and all that malarkey. He's still very much in the field. Well, before the allegations came out, he was still very much in the field. He was still very much outside. But I think everything I've heard so far about Diddy just sounds like regular party boy shit. But I reckon part of the reason why this is such a big deal is what it is revealed is that hip hop, or maybe African American people, not even hip hop, African American people are intrinsically homophobic. Like, if there's one thing African American guys or men, no, people, men or women don't like, it's homosexual people. They fucking hate it. To the point where Diddy was accused of raping Cassie, right? He was accused of raping Cassie, sexually harassing, to the point of, you know, drugging, all this sort of crazy shit in that lawsuit. And no real men in hip hop really made a stink about it. They were all kind of weirdly quiet. The moment Diddy comes out and he's been accused of maybe having sexual relations with Usher and Meek Mill allegedly, suddenly all the fucking guy black Twitter and hip hop spaces kind of explode and they're like going crazy. Because intrinsically hip hop, I guess, is, you know, I'd never really noticed it before, but I guess it is incredibly misogynistic, incredibly homophobic, and they just don't stand of it in the slightest. So it probably annoys these guys more. It probably gets under their skin more that Diddy might be allegedly gay than it does that he rapes a woman. that's not really something that they give a fuck about. They kind of like, oh, it happens, isn't it? Whatever. She probably asks for it. Oh, it's Cassie. They're together. She's probably lying. But when it comes to the him maybe hooking up with dudes, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. It's like, come on, man. Come on. What do you expect him to be doing? It's fucking P. Diddy. Like, what do you expect? But anyway, let's read the article here. P. Diddy's ex-producer alleges the rapper had a sex with Meek Mill and other celebrities in the Grammy Awards trafficking drugs. Rapper Sean Diddy Combs is immersed in a new legal battle as his former producer accused him of pressuring him, and Meek Mill and others and artists to have gay sex with him in exchange for the Grammy nominations and awards. Rodney Jones, who also goes by Little Rod, on Monday filed a 70-page lawsuit for the federal district court in Manhattan against Combs, detailing the allegations of sexual assault, drug dealing, hiring sex workers, participation in various sexual activities, all of which he was forced to endure while living with Combs to work on his album. That there's a bit in the story where he says he had to like make beats in the toilet while Sean was in the shower. That's some real party boy shit, right? He's probably doing bumps in the shower somehow, right? He's got like a fucking waterproof spoon, right? He's got waterproof pills. He's got waterproof MDMA. He's doing all these drugs in the toilet, and this guy has to sit in the toilet while Diddy is like stark naked behind some frosted glass, right? Probably slapping his dick against the glass while he's fucking showering, being like, oh, sorry, excuse me. Can you imagine? Lil Rod claimed that he to have produced 9 of the tracks in Diddy's latest The Love album Off the Grid, and also paid a pittance of $21,000 despite living in Diddy's house for almost 13 months it took to work an album. He got paid $21,000 to work for 13 months on an album that was nominated for a Grammy. I'd be pissed. He came Diddy on several occasions, groped his anus. How can you grope someone's anus? You can only finger their anus, can't you? Because your anus is inside. How can someone grope it? They have to kind of like dig their hands in, though. Can you grope an anus? You can grope someone's bum. You can grope a breast. Can you grope someone's anus? You have to kind of, that's like more of a shove of the finger. Fucking hell. He groped his anus and crotch without consent and even exploited his admiration of Stevie J, whom he idolized, looked up to force him engage in homosexual acts. I don't think I could ever be forced into sucking someone's dick if I didn't want to, just because somebody I look up to told me to do it. I'm not going to lie. I think he was probably looking for any encouragement to do it anyway. Do you know what I mean? I don't think somebody that I look up to could just say, hey, someone that you like did it, you should do it too. And I just do it. It's not likely, you know? It's not likely. But again, I could be wrong. Lil Rod said that he was showed a video of Stevie J having sex with a Caucasian male without a condom. Oh, that's a big deal, right? It's not that he's having sex with a Caucasian male and you're getting shown this picture. The big deal is that he did it bareback. Honestly, these articles are fucking crazy. Without a condom. Woo. It's like, what? Why is he showing this guy this video in the first place? Anyway, and was told by Diddy, this is normal practice in the music industry. Look, even Stevie J is doing it. He attached a screenshot taken of the video to a lawsuit. So according to Twitter, according to gay Twitter, which I'm a part of, right? I follow a lot of people on there because I want to be knowledgeable and aware of what's going on the gay side of Twitter. And I want to be a part of the jokes and the memes, and those guys just have more fun over there. According to gay Twitter, that screenshot that looks like it might be featuring Stevie J and some white dude isn't Stevie J. It allegedly is some like famous scene of some guy that's, you know, fucking a dude, obviously, in the porn scene. But it's not Stevie J. It clearly isn't. If you actually see the video, the guy looks nothing like Stevie J. But of course, if you like zoom out and it's blurry, it might look like him, but it's not. Because I saw the video myself, because people were linking it on Twitter the other day. So it's not actually Stevie J. But I don't think that means he's lying. It could still be Diddy thinking it's Stevie J. And it could still be that Diddy had the video on his phone anyway. So it doesn't mean that guy lied. It just means the video he was shown, it wasn't actually Stevie J on the video. That's what I reckon. But the funny thing is, this post obviously is the one that everyone's kind of occurring to, right? In the actual lawsuit, which I've got here on the screen. The thing that was sending people crazy was the admission on this part here that alluded to maybe Meek Mill being involved with Diddy. I think it's number 71. And it says, Mr. Combs informed Mr. Jones that he had engaged in sexual intercourse with a rapper, 5, redacted, and an R&B singer, redacted, and Stevie J. So if you scroll down here, and you'll see that 5, he's a Philadelphia rapper who dated Nicki Minaj. So who else could that be apart from Meek Mill? And then you got number six here. He performed at the Super Bowl and had a successful Vegas residency. So that's obviously going to be Usher. So that's where everybody's coming from when it comes to the whole, you know, Meek Mill and Usher allegedly being involved with him. My personal thing is this, is that as much as I like Diddy as a musician, much as I love him as a cultural figure, I remember there used to be this one interview that I was obsessed with Diddy. I think it was on BET, where he kind of was talking about being a black man, right? He was talking about, oh, I love my black skin. I love my, like, it was just, I don't know, there's some videos I remember watching of his on loop because he had this kind of really cool, inspiring, motivational message about, you know, being the best version of yourself. He had this whole history of him coming up in the music industry, being an intern, and then, you know, launching Bad Boy Records and the whole Biggie thing, like just incredible soul, like musical legacy and whatnot, right? Especially with these albums as well. And further down the line, like Last Train to Paris, like I still listen to that from time to time. Like it's like an absolutely, you know, one of the best albums of all time. But one thing that I've always been a little bit perturbed by when it comes to Diddy was how he's spoken about by other people in the industry. People speak about him when it comes to business really badly, and it kind of leaves a sour taste in your mouth when you hear how he treats people. And this is one of the examples. This is Curtis and the Joe Budden podcast, and it features the producer formerly known as Young Berg, now known as Hitmaker, talking about the issues he had with Diddy and why he never really messed with him too much. And I think for me, yes, the stuff he did with Cassie is abhorrent, disgusting. You know, we can obviously know that that's flipping not on at all. And he's lucky he's Diddy, because if he wasn't, he'd probably be in prison for that. And if he's accused, the stuff he's been accused of in this lawsuit with this little Rod guy is also disgusting. But for me, the thing that really is the worst part of his personality, I think personally, is how he treats people in the music industry, especially his fellow black artists. He doesn't really, you know, he doesn't really suffer fools gladly. Suffer fools is not the right term. He doesn't give anybody any grace. He scams people. You know, he lies, he cheats, he does everything to kind of get the leg over, even though he's one of the biggest people out there. He's a billionaire, all this sort of shit. So this is the stuff to me that I think is the worst thing above all the other stuff that he does, which I think is more so like a party boy persona thing that's probably been empowered and enabled by people in the industry itself. I think this is the stuff that people should be calling out mostly, the stuff that he does to people and up and coming artists and messes with their money and shit. Let me play the video for you now.
Puffy is.
What happened?
So look.
What he did?
So Puff hit me. He like, yo, I'm doing an R&B album. I need you. You know, you the guy. You know, it's going to be London on the track. You and me. And I think that we should do everything together, blah, blah, blah. Say less. Send me some joints. I sent him a 10 clip. It's crazy shit. I think that one was in it. A bunch of stuff or whatever. And he was like, he hit me back like, man, it feel like. Like, I want that Berg shit. I'm like, stop trying to be me. Like, it sound like you trying to do what I do. Like, nigga, send me some different shit. Da, 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 da.
Get off my dick.
So I didn't send him nothing, right? I was like, fuck it. Next thing I know, the nigga reached out. They deciphered my records and reached out to everybody that I collaborated with and dissected me from the situation. So he's calling Cardiac to his house like, You need to be one of the hitmen. And this, that, and third.
Yeah.
Next thing I look up, Eric Billinger is in the Bahamas with motherfucking Puff, and they singing songs together. I'm like, when the fuck? I'm like, Eric Billinger done lived in the fucking LA his whole life. Now he with Puff and shit.
See what I mean? That's the stuff that I think makes Diddy look the worst. Asks for Hitmaker for help, doesn't get the help he wants, then goes around his back and starts to pick apart the guys he worked with to reconstruct the stuff that he did with himself, so he can get around with not working with him and get around with not paying him. That's sort of like scumbag shit that he's been doing for years, decades. No one's called it out. Joe Budden's sitting there as well, not saying a word. He knows exactly how much of a scumbag that guy is, but refuses to say anything, refuses to criticize, because what? He wants to remain in the guy's good graces. Like, it's finished, man. Diddy's finished.
Next thing I know, I'm executive producing French Montana album. Why this all happening? The nigga had an album, the intro of the album, my tag was on it. He took my tag out of it, screamed at the intro, did all the shit or whatever. And I was like, damn, this nigga is really diabolical. Like, so I wasn't fucking with him. And then I'm in Mondrian. They still like working on the album in Miami. And then he signed, ultimately, Jazzy was also on those demos. So I don't know if he knew Jazzy before, but it was also very surprising to me that now Jazzy is with Puff and this, that.
Wait, Jazzy was on some of those demos?
Yes.
Jazzy's fire too.
Yes, Jazzy's a super talented. Absolutely. So, yeah, she's amazing.
Miss you, Jazzy. We love you.
Yeah, so and I feel bad for you, Jazzy. You know what I'm saying?
I feel bad,
because, man, she attached herself to the big homie, and then the shit that's going on.
This industry is nasty.
Respectfully.
All this shit is nasty.
So,
could you imagine also getting your major look to work on Diddy's album, and then he gets accused of what he gets accused of? Like, imagine you're a pure soul. Imagine you're just trying to make your industry. You're trying to get, you know, your foot in the ladder. You're trying to make a name for yourself, trying to make some noise. You end up getting on one of the most monumental hip-hop albums of the recent years. You end up getting on Diddy's best album in recent years, an album that kind of reintroduced him back to the, you know, to the zeitgeist, that kind of make people realize, oh shit, he's actually a really good fucking musician. He's actually a really good producer. He's actually a really good artist. And then boom, after the fact, the Cassie lawsuit comes out where she alleges she was raped and she was pimped out, all this sort of stuff, and the freak offs, like, that is going to crush you. As much as you're going to have sympathy and empathy for Cassie, you're going to be like selfishly like, fuck. You're going to be so pissed.
You gotta stop that.
All of that
with
shit
that,
is disgusting.
With that being said, like, I'm like, damn. And it's the second time Puff done did this shit. Cause like when I was a kid, when I had Sexy Lady and all them songs, he called me to daddy's house. He like, man, who producing your records? I'm like, me and my brother Rob Holiday. I signed him. He's doing this shit with me. Next thing I know, he signed Rob Holiday. And it's fuck like in 2008. Mm-hmm. Put that nigga on Jets, turned the nigga against me, had him stop working with me, and all type of shit. So this is like a reoccurring type of thing.
And this sounds like regular occurrence in the music industry. Like, I've always said, I think the music industry might be one of the most evil, diabolical industries to work in. It just seems like everybody is out to get you, especially if they look like you. They'll do it even more. And I've realized one thing as well in the music industry, from what I've heard from people, is that when you get fucked over in the music industry, instead of it making you into a person that doesn't want to fuck up other people, it just makes you want to do it to other people. You know, because somebody else fucked you over, you want to do it to somebody else. And I get the feeling some people feel as if, I know Joe said this, as if like, if you get into the music industry, you have to get fucked over. It's almost like a rite of passage. So they'd rather they do it because they look like you and they're from the same area, place as you, as opposed to somebody else, which it doesn't make any sense really, because getting fucked over is getting fucked over. Getting scammed. Doesn't matter if the person's black, white, Asian, whatever. If there's someone scamming you, it's always going to hurt, especially if they're fucking taking money out of your pocket or taking food off your table to like feed your family and shit. It's always going to be horrible and you're never going to, you know, take it well. But that is some of the thinking that people have in their head. Like, okay, I got fucked over. This record producer fucked me over. This label fucked me over. This agent did. This manager did. I'm now going to do it to somebody else who's unaware of what's going on. It's completely naive. It's coming into it green and wide-eyed. I'm going to fuck them over too, which I think is diabolical, which is why the good people in the industry who do go out of their way to do good business, who do go out of their way to rewrite the wrongs, who do go out of their way to set an example, should be credited and should be kind of lauded, because most people in the industry don't do that.
And then from there, it really hurt even more, because now he dissected my records and took it, and I'm in Atlanta, and he had his A&R reached out to Tink's manager, like, yeah, I think we want Tink on this R&B project.
Jesus
this
Christ.
I'm like, wait, that what? So of course I was
I'm
like,
serious, I'm not even joking.
Nah,
Tink would have been fire on that. Bro.
I hate it. What do you think about everything else he's saying, though?
Exactly.
Might have been too Rob Holiday. Who knows?
Exactly. Well done to fucking, what's her name? For saying, like, forget the Tink thing. What about all the other stuff he said about Diddy? Oh, let's just forget about that. Like, all the evidence of him being a complete dirtbag and piece of shit. Let's forget about that because he's got money. I hate that way of thinking. I really fucking do hate it.
I hate it.
That's
on that.
Bob Holiday.
And then from there,
y'all call him Rob.
Yeah.
I will never speak to that nigga again.
Jazzy and Tink album dropped at the same time. Tink's last album, and Tink was number one. And then he called me. He like, nigga, you in good company. Jazzy number two, Tink number one. You in good company. I'm like, nigga, you in good company. What the fuck you talking about? Exactly. I'm number one. What are you talking about? He like, nigga, you don't know the type of money I'd have spent. Nigga, you ain't going to be in that spot for long. And shit, you know, I stayed in that spot, and she didn't. But shout out to Puff.
Big up Hitmaker, man. Big up Berg. He's seen some shit. I would love to read Hitmaker's autobiography. If he ever did an autobiography, if he ever writ one, if he ever put one together, but I would love to read it because I think he has some stories. He definitely went through the ringer. He definitely had his ups and downs. He came out of it at the other end and turned himself into a super producer. Legitimately, some of his credits are insane. Some of the stuff that he's actually been a part of in terms of constructing and whatnot, careers he's helped to revive. Like, the guy is the real deal. So I would legitimately love to hear his stories because, you know, despite him being relatively young, he's lived a fucking rich life. He's been through shit in the industry and he could definitely give it up because he's not afraid, because obviously he has a talent to kind of back it up and shit. So I'd love to hear more from him going forward. I would really love to hear more from him going forward. Talking about going forward, let's talk about Burberry Fall 2024 Ready to Wear collection. I've got some of my highlights here on the screen that I thought I would pick out in terms of, you know, some of the stuff that I did like. The rest of it, obviously, I didn't like. But I think just to give you an overall, you know, my overall view, I'm still of the thinking that most of it just looks very frumpy. Daniel Lee hasn't been able to execute that crisp, almost minimalistic feel he had when he was at Bottega Veneta. And maybe the reason why is because it wasn't really his doing. Because we're seeing that Matteo Blasi now, that he's now taken over at Bottega Veneta, somebody that was part of his team while he was there, he's been able to keep up that sort of aesthetic that we saw when Bottega first came around and it was pretty successful. I think it might have been at 2019 or something. But nowadays, when Daniel Lee's gone to Burberry, we've not seen that same level of finish, that same level of crispness, that same minimalism, that same cleanliness. It all just looks a bit frumpy. It all looks a little bit too all over the place. It all looks a little bit too layered. It all looks a little bit too messy. I just don't like it personally. I think it looks horrendous. And one thing I've realized checking up some of these pictures is that some of the pieces are okay in the actual looks going down the runway. But together, styled, they're not the greatest. So even the stuff that I don't like in the collection, it might be quite decent if it's styled better. But I think the styling of this collection is really does leave a lot to be desired. But individually, there are some pieces in here that are pretty decent. Number one look on the runway features Agnes Dean, which is a pretty good nod. So I think one thing Daniel Lee's done really well at Burberry is reintroduce Burberry into the cultural zeitgeist and let it become like a cool brand. He has all the right people at the front row, loads of interesting icons in culture when it comes to Britain and whatnot. Great, amazing, we love to see it. And obviously Agnes Dean being a legendary model, it was great to see her on the runway again. She doesn't, I think she's retired if I'm not mistaken. So she be able to kind of open this Burberry show was pretty cool to see. No, don't get me wrong. And the look itself was, you know, fairly okay. The pants are pretty nice. There are some decent stuff that I like this knitted dress thing with some of the tassels on the end was pretty cool. Even though I'm not a fan of brown on black people's skin, I don't know why I'm one of those weirdos that don't like wearing brown, even though it probably would look good on me. I really did like this look as well in this jacket. I think the top half is really cool. I like the top half. The rest of it I don't like at all. The top half with the Burberry scarf wrapped around his head like he's a babushka is really nice. The cut of this leather pilot or flight jacket is really cool. But then the pants are horrendous. Like, I don't know why he designed the pants this way with these like zips on the front. Like, I think on the along the pleat line where you can zip them both ways and sort of like have your knee kind of poking out. I don't know. I don't really get the use of those sort of pants. I think they look horrible personally. I quite like this suit look here, even though the tailoring doesn't look the greatest and it looks kind of frumpy. I quite like that suit look. I'm not gonna lie, that suit look is definitely something that I would definitely wear. It's kind of like in a yellowy ombre kind of color. I'm a real big fan of that. I love this coat. This fur coat is beautiful, I'm not gonna lie. I'm not sure if it's fur, pile, whatever it may be. Maybe it's sheepskin, who knows? But whatever this finish is in this yellow colorway is absolutely gorgeous. Like, I love this coat. That coat looks really cool. And obviously the boots, I also do like them as well. This look with this model, again, I'm not too sure if it's the model looking like a badass or if it's the clothes that fit them amazing. But this looks great. The scarf on top of the dress, which is underneath the jacket, and you got the grey boots. I'm really fond of that one. So that's one of my favourites as well. You've got a really nice, great look here with this dress on the inside is amazing. It almost looks like a really big scarf, you know? That's what it kind of looks like. It almost looks like a really big scarf that's been kind of transformed into a dress. I really like, do like the look of that one. You've got another model too. I think her name is like Lily Coles or something. I think she's a model that was like in university. She studied something like mathematics or something. She's super brainy, but happened to also be like a runway model. She's like a legend from back in the day. I think it's like Lily something. I think if I'm not mistaken. So she was on the runway too. I loved her look as well. Her look was fucking banging. I love this jacket. It looks like it's a jacket that has like an inside lining. It makes it look like it's got a scarf on the inside, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it's been styled that way. But I do like that jacket. I think that's a really hard look, especially with the boots, and then you got this like detail of the little chain around the ankle. I think that looks really cool. I also love this coat. Again, the coats in the collection were really cool. This coat, I think it's called a funnel neck, if I'm not mistaken, where the collar sort of like comes right up above your neck like that. I think this is really cool. I love the clasp as well on the side there, where you can sort of like, you know, lock the fucking jacket on. I think that looks really nice. I'm not gonna lie, I love the look of that. So that looks really cool. And then you've got some nice and again the pants and the boots I'm not really too fond of, but I think that jacket, that coat as a coat itself, looks absolutely stupendous. Naomi Campbell was there as well, even though she's been shrouded in controversy. You know, she's been accused of being, you know, on flipping Epstein's island. She's been accused of being a bully. Loads of things been going on there, but one thing about Auntie Naomi, she always turns up for work. She always turns up for work. She catches a check, keeps it moving. So Auntie Naomi looked pretty cool as well. Again, an extension of that kind of like furry, piley looking dress thing that kind of looks similar to the scarf. I kind of like the look of that as well. So big up Auntie Naomi for not letting the naysayers distract her from collecting the checks and cashing in her money. I love this jacket also. Same sort of flavor. You got these really nice tassels at the end. This sort of reminds me a little bit of the Prada jacket from previous seasons of menswear that everyone's been going crazy about. It's the Prada jacket that's got this sort of like on the arms, it's sort of like got these like furry kind of stripes around the arms and shit. It kind of reminds a little bit of that, but instead of got them around the arms, you got them at the end here of the cuff, and you got some bottom bits here towards the hem as well. Again, a lovely jacket. The jackets in this collection are always great, with this great funnel neck, and I guess it's got this like guard with studded buttons on the thing that you can clip on the front as well. That looks fucking fantastic. And of course, this big skirt, which is probably one of my favorite looks, I'm not going to lie. This look here at the end might be one of my favorites from the actual whole collection itself. I really do like the look of that. That was definitely one of my favorite ones. But again, like I said, it's been quite underwhelming. Daniel Lee at Burberry, not really been pulling up any trees. I've been out a few times lately, and I haven't seen many people wearing this stuff. I've seen some scarves here and there, but I haven't seen a lot of people actually wearing the shit on the road. The people I've seen on social media wearing it look like they get it for free, or they at least buy it for cost value or something. They got some connection with Burberry. They know some people in fashion. I haven't seen a lot of regular people wearing it. I've not seen a lot of Asian people. I've not seen a lot of black people. I just haven't seen it. And I think even Ricardo Tisci at fucking Burberry earlier on, he was at least, I saw a few people wearing the stuff that he designed there. I think that famously that jacket, that bomber jacket, the puffer that everyone was wearing, I think it might have been, I forgot who wore it first actually, but that was really popular at the time. But I haven't seen anybody really checking it out, even though Skepta wears it quite well and does his bit with it. I haven't seen a lot of regular people out there fucking stunting and making it look good. So it doesn't seem like it's really hit the cultural zeitgeist really, but again, you know, maybe it will improve along the way, but I really do doubt it. But those were some of my favorite pieces from Burberry recently. Next on the list here, we got this article courtesy of Variety regarding BuzzFeed selling Complex to Network for $108.6 million, laying off 60% of the remaining workforce, which is kind of hilarious because Complex is fucking shit. I follow a few people on Twitter who are like Complex writers and stuff, and they always seem to have the worst opinions. I don't think I've ever met a single person who works at Complex on social media who doesn't just have the worst take. So a part of me would like to celebrate that these guys are all getting fired, but having been on the chopping block myself and having been at companies where people get laid off en masse, it's never a good feeling. It's never never a nice feeling, and I wouldn't want to show my worst enemy. So I do want to give all my support, all my solidarity to people out there from Complex who did get fired. Hopefully you land on your feet. Hopefully you figure something out. You know you're not alone. The feeling that you have now is fleeting and it will subside, even though it's painful and it really does hurt, especially that confusion, that anxiety of what your future is going to be. Do know that that feeling will pass. And as soon as you get another job, you'll probably quickly forget about that period of time that you were there anyway. So love and solidarity to all of my fallen Complex comrades out there. So let's read the article. It says BuzzFeed has sold Complex, the youth cultural media company it bought 3 years ago, and will pink slip another 16% of the BuzzFeed remaining staffers in a restructuring redesigned. Let's read that one more time. BuzzFeed has sold Complex, the youth cultural media company it bought 3 years ago, and will pink slip another 16% of BuzzFeed's remaining staffers in a restructuring designed to get back on financial track. BuzzFeed announced on Wednesday that it closed the sale of Complex to the e-commerce platform Network in a $108.6 million all-cash deal. The LA-based Network said that together with Complex, it will build a next generation of content and shopping experience, and that it described it as a new destination for superfans, culture that will define the future of commerce, digital media, and music. Investors in the newly merged company include Universal Music Group, Jimmy Iovine, Main Street Advisors, and Goldman Sachs. I'm surprised, I'm not going to lie, I'm actually surprised that Network has $108 million to spend. Because I check out some of their videos online. If I'm going to go check out their YouTube right now, again, YouTube isn't a good reflection, I guess, of a company. But because they operate in like the streetwear, fashion-y type of sector, there's not a lot of people or companies that do that online, especially on YouTube. So you'd imagine there'd be a lot of like demand for it, especially with the labels and the names they have attached to them. But I'm just checking on their Network app now, or no, Network account on YouTube. Their YouTube account has 25.9 subscribers, right? And I think I've got 21,000, so it's not that many at all. They've got videos on here featuring who? We've got videos here featuring Blasi from Reconnect, has got 10K. We've got videos here with only 189 views, videos with 619 views. Like, crazy. Like, to think that this company that doesn't do any bits on online hardly gets any traction with some of the stuff that they put out online. They've got a video here with Swiss Beats from 2 years ago, only got 23,000 views. Like, how they're able to generate or raise £108 million or dollars, sorry, to buy Complex in the first place is crazy. And then to use that money to buy Complex is fucking insane, right? If you got 108 point million to spend, maybe spend that in investing in your company, not buying Complex. Like, what the fuck are they going to do with Complex? Like, it's already dead. You know what I mean? It's already on this last breath, if anything. So, like, so BuzzFeed really kind of cashed out on that one. It continues. In addition to the $108.6 million purchase price, BuzzFeed received an approximately $5.7 million related to Complex's use of the company's new York offices and severance and other employee-related costs. BuzzFeed acquired Complex Networks in 2021. Approximately they lost a lot of money on that, right? BuzzFeed acquired Complex for $198 million in cash and $96 million in equity for a total price tag of $294 million. So basically Network were able to buy it under half price. However, that included Complex's first week feast brand, produced by the popular Hot One series, which was not sold to Network. So Network bought it for 108, but it didn't get the most popular show, which is Hot Ones. Fuck. Along with the Complex sale, BuzzFeed announced that its new round of layoffs to cut expenses, implementing a 16% reduction in its remaining workforce, a bit under 1,000 people across the company. I love how these articles never say the number first. They always say the percentage. I guess to take away the human factor, the real life factor of actual real life people being impacted by these layoffs. People that are not sure where their next meal is going to come from. They're not sure how they're going to pay rent. They're not sure how they're going to put their kids through school. They're all worried, right? So they don't want to put the numbers of the people there because it's going to make people freak out. So they always put the percentages. But 1,000 people is a lot of people, bro, who are going to lose their full-time salaries. Like, so love and solidarity to all those people. The BuzzFeed job cuts are expected to yield approximately $23 million. God damn. The salaries at Complex must be substantial, innit? That's the thing that I really didn't do well when I was in my social media management, marketing sort of like roles. I don't think I negotiated my salaries well. I don't think so. I think I was a little bit too, because I was so gung-ho and so dead sure that I was gonna make it outside of my work. I didn't need to like have a job. I was kind of a bit arrogant and kind of took jobs a bit lightly. When I did get a job, I'll just take the offer because I knew I wasn't really bothered about it. I was just like, cool, I'm gonna do my own thing. I'm gonna be DJing, I'm gonna be producing, I'm gonna be fucking podcasting. I mean, I didn't really care about it, but I think that not caring about it fucked me because I was definitely underpaid in a lot of the roles I took. I definitely should have negotiated for more because people do get paid a lot for those shitty jobs that I have or those nonsense jobs I've had where you're a community manager or you're a marketing manager, marketing assistant, marketing executive, onboarding executive, community manager, I've said before, right? All these type of things that don't really mean much. Instead of just like, all I did is basically write newsletters every week, post 5 days a week on fucking social media, do some paid marketing, spend shit. That's all I basically did. And I was getting paid like, I think the highest I got paid when I was doing that with those roles might be like 35,000, maybe. Yeah, 35, 37,000, which isn't a lot really, especially when you consider that a lot of people that work in those fields can sometimes get 50, 60 plus. So I definitely fucked myself because from 1,000 people to be able to get 23 million, like that's a lot. That means you're paying those people a lot of money. It continues. The layoffs of the BuzzFeed in April 2023 announced was shuttering its profitable BuzzFeed News division and laying off around 108 people. Going forward, BuzzFeed will focus on optimizing sustainable revenue streams with the highest margins, centered on 4 brand pillars: BuzzFeed, First We Feast, HuffPost, Tasty. The sale of Compex represents an important strategic step to BuzzFeed Inc. as we adapt our business to a more profitable, more nimble, and more innovative BuzzFeed CEO, Jonah Peretti said in a statement. This is also an opportunity to unlock greater value of the Complex brand by combining the network's expansive e-commerce driven business. I'm really curious to see what happens with Network. Like I said, because I don't think Network is really going to be here for the long term. I'll be surprised, but the fact that they have 108 million to spend must mean they're doing something right. But let's see what Network do with Complex. But RIP Complex, RIP people that work there, and hopefully you guys all land on your feet. Hopefully all you guys land on your feet. We can only hope and pray. Moving on from that one, I wanted to quickly mention this, courtesy of Junction 2. So Junction 2 have released their lineup for their festival, which is coming up very soon. I've mentioned it previously on the podcast. I think Junction 2 might be one of the best festivals in London, purely for the sound. If you've been to other festivals in London, you'd know the sound is garbage, right? Garbage in most London festivals. You have to literally go right to the front to hear it. And I don't know about you, but when I go to a festival, the last thing I want to be doing is be crammed up right at the front gate, fucking staring up as fucking, Two Door Cinema Club play their tracks. I'd rather be far at the back. I'd rather be eating a hot dog, a little glizzy. I'd rather be having some drinks, having some bumps, and doing it from that distance as opposed to right at the front. But unfortunately, because of local licensing laws and all this malarkey, a lot of festivals can't have their sound cranked up super high, so you have to kind of make do what you have. Junction 2 is different. Junction 2 is different maybe because of where it's at. It's in the west of London, Boston Manor Park. Maybe those boroughs aren't as strict as we are here in like the east central side of fucking London. That might be the reason why. And the other reason why, it might be because the actual festival is in a park that's underneath. It's in a park next to a motorway, but the main stage is underneath a motorway. It's underneath like a dual carriage overpass thing. So because of that, they can really crank up the volume. And because of the dual carriageway that goes over the top of the main venue, you also get incredible acoustics. It kind of like traps the sound a little bit. So if you're looking for a London festival to go to and you don't mind traveling, especially because if you live in East, traveling to Boston Manor is a slog. I'm not going to lie. Like, I remember we went there a couple of years and it's like a legit hour and a half journey to get from like east all the way to west, because it's like literally on the opposite ends of the fucking line and shit. So it's a really hard place to get to. Maybe now it's not so much hard, especially with the overground. I might make the train journey a bit easier, but it's still a long distance. But if you don't mind traveling, I do recommend going. It's great value for money, great DJs, great organization. Only thing that's a bit annoying, to be fair to the experience I had, the security is a bit heavy-handed. They're a little bit aggressive. They can really get into your face and spoil your mood, I'm not going to lie. But if you can put up with the security checks, if you're smart about where you stash your shit and whatever, and if me personally, I prefer to just go to festivals stone sober, not drink anything, and then just start while I get there. Because the paranoia and anxiety when you're in the queue and you think someone's looking at you and they want to, it's just too much. So I'd rather just go there somewhat sober and then start to ramp up as you go in. But if you're okay with doing that and you're okay with getting searched and getting sometimes even strip searched, once you get through those gates, it's a pretty decent festival. I'm not going to lie. Loads of places to go to buy drinks, great selection of food, great places to hang out and chill, great little rooms where you can kind of go and see people, like stages and shit, whatever it may be. And I think this lineup is probably one of my favorites as well. But This lineup, oddly enough, one of the interesting lineups that I like about it is the Saturday. So a lot of people are into going on the Friday and the Sunday, but I honestly think the Saturday might be my favorite lineup. I'm not going to lie. The Saturday features Adam Beyer, back-to-back with Emily Lenz. I don't give a fuck about that. Avalon Emerson, love. Daniel Avery, back-to-back with Samuel Abdul-Lahid, love. DVS1, back-to-back with DJ Nobu. That's going to be fucking killer on the Saturday. That's a really good lineup. Fiaka playing, Gabriel Kwarteng, who I'm a big fan of. Hi, who I love. Jacko, Jeff Mills, the fucking legend. John Hopkins, legend. Juliet Fox, Kessie. Kiki's going to be sick. LSDXOXO will be great. That venue, I think LSDXOXO playing his brand of like party dance music, electronic music, especially considering by that time, I think the EP would have dropped. He's got loads of remixes out. He's been having an absolutely crazy last 18 months, I think. So that'll be great to see him play in that kind of field or in that sort of environment. Mary Moxamia, who's an absolute killer. That'd be great to see. Oxtix, who I know. Renee Wise, right? Because I'm the fucking chairman of the Renee Wise Fan Club. So seeing Renee Wise play there is going to be absolutely sick. He's going to be there. Richie Horton, Tape Feed, VTSSS, who, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of VTSS, but still, I think a VTSS alongside the LSDXOXO will give the place a little bit of a fun, carefree, chill vibe. So if you're really looking for a place to go to and you're not too sure where you want to fucking rave at, especially for the summer, especially for festivals, because a lot of them are quite expensive and not that great value for money, I really recommend you check out Junction 2. Even though it's had a bit of a, you know, they had some flops in terms of some festivals, because I think they had to move it one time and I wasn't really too fond of the location they moved it to. But now they're back in Boston Manor Park. It's going to take place from Friday the 26th to Sunday the 28th of July 2024. So definitely check them out if you haven't already. Great fucking lineup from Friday to Saturday to Sunday. Maybe it might be an option, actually. I might actually check if I'm actually going to go on a Saturday. I might actually check whether or not I could get a little cheeky Airbnb near it, because honestly, the journey back home is muerto. You know what I mean? It's fucking crazy. So I'm actually looking to seeing if I could check out and get a little fucking cheeky, you know, Airbnb next to Boston Manor Park, because Junction 2 is actually a bit of a vibe. And if I'm only in it for the one day, I think that might actually be a good thing to check out. Let me actually check in to see if they've got tickets for the day. Junction 2 Festival 2024. Let's see if they've got any tickets for the actual day only. Let's see if they've got Saturday tickets. Maybe they don't, because sometimes they do split them in a weird way. But let's see. So this is courtesy of RA. We've got the page loading up on here. 26th of July, Boston Manor Park. Yeah, you got Saturday tickets. So Friday, so all the tickets, you can buy tickets for each day. They're available. Basically 71.25 plus the £7 booking fee, which is pretty decent. So you can obviously buy them separately if you want to as well. Third release already available, so definitely check them out if you are that way inclined. So pretty decent, especially if you're considering the lineup you're going to get for it. 70 quid for all those DJs playing is pretty good. I'm not going to lie, 70 quid for all DJs is pretty good. I'm not going to lie. Big up Junction 2. Moving on from Junction 2 and moving on to other kind of twos, let's also talk a little bit about this before I leave you lovely people. So it's courtesy of Hypebeast. Awake NY unveils their full Jordan brand collection. I'm still not sure where I stand on this. I know the Airship has a lot of history when it comes to sneakerheads. I know it was one of the first Jordans. I know it's got synonymous with Michael Jordan because it was the shoe that he could wear when the Jordan 1, I think, was banned from the NBA. I forgot what the real story behind it, but there's a real history around the Airship. Personally, I think it looks a bit off. It kind of looks like a, like, it kind of looks like a Team Jordan, if that makes any sense to me. I know it's not a Team Jordan, but it kind of has Team Jordan aesthetics to it. So it's not quite a Jordan 1. It's not quite a Dunk. It's just kind of in its own little place. It's not quite a Vandal. It's not quite a Terminator. It just occupied its own little space. But to be fair to Awake, they did a really good job on these, right? They've got this amazing white upper, crisp white upper. You've got this lovely red snakeskin collar at the top. You've got this grey swoosh with this red border line going around it, which kind of makes the swoosh really pop really well. And what I really love about them is the toe box. I didn't notice this at first, right? Look at the toe box. The toe box, if I'm not mistaken, is like a suede. Maybe my eyes are bad, but it looks like you've got plain leather on the upper here, and then the toe box has this like weird suede-y nubucky finish, if I'm not mistaken. And then it's got this kind of A on the dot here written on the top as well. And then you've also got this stained yellow midsole to give it that vintage flavor, right? So something that you kind of plucked out from a box from the 80s. So I quite like the finish. Again, maybe I'm wrong here. That could be incorrect, but I think that toe box area is suede. So you've got this nice suede-y type of area when you wear that in, and you get some scuffs on it and shit, that'll wear in really nicely, and it'll contrast really well with the crisp plain white leather upper on the main majority of the shoe. And then you've also got this nice nylon tongue here, foam tongue with some flat laces as well. So I quite look like them. Like I said, I'm not the biggest fan of Nike Air Ships in general, but I quite like those. I don't like the jacket. I'm probably not the biggest fan of. Personally, for me, the varsity jacket I can probably miss out on. The t-shirt is hard. I really like that t-shirt featuring the Awake logo with the Jordan brand motif on the inside. The varsity jacket isn't for me though. It just looks a little bit too American, if that makes any sense. The varsity jacket looks too American for me. The hoodie is really cool. I quite like the shorts. The shorts here look really nice. I'd wear the fuck out of those shorts. You've got the Nike swoosh here. You've got this cement type print on here. You've got the Awake logo with the Jordan Jumpman logo as well. I'm not too sure if that hat is included there, but it looks pretty cool. There's also earrings. Look at that. I wonder if the earrings come with the clothing. There's also these crazy hoop earrings that feature the Awake logo and the Jordan brand as well. They look pretty cool. Then you've also got this trench coat. The trench coat kind of reminds me of Raf Simons. Raf Simons trench coat, the legendary one with all the kind of stripes and badges, it kind of reminds you of that. So you've got a logo, you've got a design here of Jordan dunking, and then you've got a basketball hoop and Awake here logo branding on a trench coat. Again, a bit strange to have this on a Chesterfield on an overcoat, but you know, I fuck with it, I'm not gonna lie. You've got a pullover hoodie with the logo on it as well, which looks really cool. Again, the varsity jacket, maybe it's just me, it just looks too American. I couldn't wear this. It looks too American. It's too kind of gaudy for my liking, but I like the hoodie. I definitely wear the fuck out of that hoodie. The shorts I like. Again, yeah, the back, it's just, there's too much going on here. You got 2020, you got the numbers on the sleeve, you got the snakeskin underneath the fucking what you call it, the armpit. You've got the Awake logo here. You've got the New York or the Jumpman. It's just too much going on there for me. It's just too much stuff going on there for me personally. Oh, the flannel is part of it too. Okay, I like that flannel. This bleach flannel is fucking hard. There's a flannel shirt that also features the Awake and Jordan brand logo. And the logo on the back has been done bleached wise. So I'm guessing they just probably covered it. Or maybe just drew it with a bleach gun. I'm not too sure how they actually did that design, but or maybe it's just screen printed, I'm not too sure. But either way, or blasted with some sort of light. I really like that design there. You've also got some jeans are featured there. The t-shirt, what else do they have here? Also, you got the shoes as well featured there as well. They look pretty cool. Nike Air logo on the end, and obviously the jacket as well featured, which I don't really a fan of. Maybe a jacket would have worked better if it was all red, I'm not gonna lie. Maybe the jacket should be all red. That might have been really nice. There's also a sweatshirt obviously style as well that looks pretty cool. You got the whole sweatsuit. I'd wear this. This sweatsuit's for me. You got the pullover hoodie and the sweatpants. I'd wear the fuck out of that, hands down. The flannel shirt is super hard. I love that with all the fucking tie-dye thing going on there as well, or the bleached fucking thing going on. That looks pretty cool. The t-shirt looks great as well, and the shorts. But yeah, I love it. I really do like it. I'm not going to lie. The shoes, I'm kind of turning my opinion on them. I wonder if there's going to be another colorway. I think I saw a blue as well. I know it's red here, but I'm pretty sure I saw a blue colorway as well recently. But maybe we'll see that later on down the line. Let's check the Hypebeast article. It says, Awaken Y has officially unveiled his collection with Jordan Brand, centered around the Awaken Y and Jordan Brand Airship, the first collaborative sneaker between the two parties, offering a 7-piece capsule collection. The collection is also a love letter to New York City's influence on basketball and street culture. It's also somewhat of a full circle moment for both parties, as Michael Jordan was born in the Fort Greene, Brooklyn, before his family moved to Mexico, to Wilmington, North Carolina, an under radar piece of MJ's history, much the same way that Airship was a long hidden part of his footwear lineage. Jordan Brand accolade. So when did Jordan come out? Have we got a release date for it just yet? You got the stuff down there. Any release date? Let's see what the date is. Oh, okay, no date so far. There we go. Date's probably here. Is it there? No date still. No fucking date. Release information for the Awake Jordan Brand Airship is forthcoming. We'll be sure to update you. So we've got all the details. We've got the two colorways. See, we've got the blue as well. That blue is fucking lovely. I love that blue, actually. That blue is really nice. Either colorway I'd probably be happy to have. But that flannel and that sweatsuit is definitely things that I would fucking wear the fuck out of. I'm not going to lie. That flannel there and that fucking sweatsuit is super, 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 super hard. So big up fucking Awake. Big up Jordan Brand as well. Can't wait to see when he's eventually drop. I'm curious to see what the price will be, because Airships aren't Jordan 1s, but will they just price them the same price as Jordan 1s because they're a collaboration? I'm not too sure. But they should be cheaper. They should be cheaper, but I doubt they're going to be cheaper. Let's see what the price is when they come out. Anyway, my friends, that has been the Axino Zynga Show, episode number 751. Thank you so much for tuning into the show. It's been a pleasure to have your company. If you're listening to this show via the podcast apps, you will hear my tune of the day playing underneath my voice right now, and you'd be surprised to hear what the tune of the day is. Don't be triggered. It's just music, I guarantee you. It's not an endorsement of the person. It's just the flipping music. If you're listening to the audio side of the podcast, please also make sure you leave me a 5-star review on all the platforms that you use. You can leave me a 5-star review on Spotify, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, whatever you use. Leave me a quick 5-star review so people know that you're enjoying the show. If you're listening to this show, watching the show via the YouTube platform, make sure you smash the like button down below. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you think of the show. That'd be greatly appreciated also. And of course, if you have any questions, you can contact me via the link in the description. There'll be a contact button there that you can click on the link there. You can send it a fucking email via the main podcast page. But apart from that, I'll see you guys again very, very soon. Thank you for tuning in. It's been a pleasure and never a chore. And I hope you have a great day and the rest of the week. Take care, people. Peace.
I've been patient. Patiently waiting, I've been faking for a long time. And now I want you. Ooh, I want you. Oh, patiently waiting, I've been faking for a long time. Now I want you. Ooh, I want you. You got me all of my feelings. Where's it taking this long? I need you running to my arms. Jealous for you, but I just can't help it. I don't wanna waste time, oh no. I don't wanna waste time, oh no. I don't wanna take your life for granted. I just wanna cherish every second. You and me together, what a blessing.
please just tell me that you get the message. No, I don't. You and me, you and me, oh. Ecstasy, ecstasy, oh. For you, but I just can't help it. No way. I don't wanna waste time. I don't wanna waste time. Oh no. I don't wanna waste time. I don't wanna waste time. Oh no. Time. I don't know which time, oh no.
Stay in your bag, get in your bag, stay in your bag. 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 Get in your bag, stay in your bag.